Hey, uplifters. I want to take a minute to talk about something personal to me. In my 40s, I started noticing my hair was shedding more. So a couple of months ago, I started using Nutrafol. I'm already seeing so much less shedding. And my teenage daughter, who notices absolutely everything, keeps commenting on how thick my hair looks. As someone who's built my career around rigorous science, I super love that Nutrafol was the first brand to clinically study hair thinning on menopausal women, which is why I am so proud to have them as a sponsor. Nutrafol takes a whole body approach to hair health, supporting you throughout your life stages. You can see thicker, stronger, faster growing hair with less shedding in just 3 to 6 months. For a limited time, Nutrafol is offering our listeners $10 off your first month subscription and free shipping when you go to Nutrafol.com and enter the promo code UPLIFTERS. Welcome to the Uplifters podcast, where every week I get the super awesome privilege of talking to women over 40 who are doing big, brave things in the world. This week, I get to talk to Kirsten Barnett. She's the executive director of the New York Job CEO Council, where she's leading a coalition of Fortune 100 CEOs from companies you've heard of like JP Morgan, IBM, Google, Citigroup, who have all committed to hiring 100,000 low-income New Yorkers into family-sustaining jobs by 2030. Remarkably, they are already more than halfway toward that audacious goal. Prior to this, Kirsten spent 15 years at Bloomberg, where she led gender equality and helped shape how major companies globally are reporting on social sustainability. Kirsten also co-founded the US 30% Club, a group of influential CEOs, including Warren Buffett and Larry Fink, and sits on several nonprofit and advisory boards. And yet, Kirsten, with all of this background, you probably didn't come into life with a crystal ball, knowing you were going to do all this big, important work in your life.
That's so true. I don't think I knew any of the jobs I've had existed until basically just before I had them. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I think in some of them, you have likely created the category and the conversation around these things.
Yes, which I think we're going to see even more of just as we think about where the future of work is going. I think that's so true. I often tell younger people when they say, I want your job or I want that job, I'm like, don't want those jobs. That job's either going to be a tenth of a job in a year or it's going to be 10 jobs in a year. So just focus on what you like to do and moving forward. Yeah.
Well said. I love that. Yeah. I've given similar advice to my kids, which is, I have no idea where the world is going. So you might as well do something you really love doing and see what happens, because none of us actually have a crystal ball on that.
Yeah, actually, I have a funny story on that. My first job at Bloomberg, I was 22 or 23, and I was interviewing for an assistant role in the president's office. And my final interview was with him. And I remember I read Bloomberg by Bloomberg cover to cover the night before. I prepared so much. I'm thinking the interview's going well. And at the end, the last question he asked me is, so what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, I don't know. I haven't figured it out yet. And I left and thought, what a stupid answer. Like, I can't believe I didn't have an answer. Just you should have said Bloomberg, like, to start. And later, I was told that he left the interview and said to his chief of staff, I like her. I asked her what she wanted to be when she grew up, and she said she hadn't figured it out yet. He said, me neither. So anyway,
I love that. So as a 20-year-old, what did you feel like was most important for you to bring to your work life?
I think as a 20-year-old, I was so focused on what I thought was a straight path. And I actually think at 20, you know, I'm about to graduate college, and I was already thinking, how many years do I need to work till I can go to business school? What's the average? What am I supposed to, I mean, it was, my mindset was not always the way it is now, as fluid. But I think that can really hold people back, because then most of the times when I veered from that path are actually when, you know, exceptional opportunities happened.
What a great answer. And you're 42 now. How do you, as a woman, officially now, at least according to average lifespans and for women in the US in the second half of your life, how do you think about what's important in choosing the roles that you take?
Yeah. So that definitely changes over time. And that's also advice I give to young people. I mean, there's so many reasons you take a job and there's so many reasons you stay in a job. And so there have been times in my life, like when I was 20, when, you know, finances were exceptionally important, had to pay the rent. If I was going to live in New York, you got to pay your bills. I feel like I'm at a point in my life right now that is also still important, money. But for me, the impact piece is really important. I have two small children, and if I'm going to leave them every day, I need to feel really good about what I'm leaving them for and good about the example I'm setting. So I think that, you know, things change. There were also periods in my career where growth was the most important. And I just wanted to make sure I was moving onward and upward at, you know, at a period when often women and others tend to get stalled. So I think it's important to diagnose at that specific point in time what is important to you. And yeah, it's not always going to be the same thing.
What is right for right now is the question I often ask.
What is right for right now? Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And so for you at this stage, how do you measure success?
I am lucky enough that I feel for most of my career, I have been excited to get up and go to work every day. And obviously, everyone has bad days, but that's for the most part how I feel. I feel like if that changes, then it probably means it's time to move on. But as long as that's going, then I think that feels successful. Again, having a family, you redefine what success looks like so much because you need to find that balance. And I think of balance not in a week or a month, but more like in a year. Do I feel overall that I'm, you know, spending enough time with my children? I'm able to focus on what's important now in my marriage. And also being able to have the impact that I want to have in what I'm doing professionally. And yeah, I think if those things feel right, then like not broken, don't fix it. And when those things start to feel off is usually when it means you need to rebalance your priorities.
I think as we grow up, I'm not even sure if that's the word for it, but it feels like, you know, in the spirit of, there is research that shows our growth mindset peaks in our 40s. And so we are, as you said, you talked about growing as in sort of positional power, right? Like you have titles and influence and the ability to make broader impact, but we're growing in terms of our understanding, our knowledge, our networks, all of that as we age too. And so as you think about that now, what do you feel like is most important for keeping you in a growth mindset? Especially as a leader, where I think there can be a tendency sometimes to like be at the top of an organization and feel a little bit like you have to have all the answers. And so you stop asking questions.
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah. I think that asking questions is so important, both in leadership, but in being effective at any job. It's one of the things I look for most when hiring people too, is a sense of curiosity, because that's what's going to lead you to ask the right questions. And, you know, part of the reason you have diverse teams, as spoken about before, is because then everyone's going to ask different questions and you need a lot of different questions. You need people to poke a lot of different holes. I mean, ultimately that's when innovative things happen. But yeah, I love to feel challenged. I love to learn. And so there's a period of your life where that's happening in the classroom. There's a period in my life when I thought that was going to happen in business school. Instead, I took a chief of staff job. I now say that was my business school. I followed a global leader around the world to 40 countries and met with colleagues and clients and was learning every day. And so I think as long as I can feel like I'm absorbing new information, and that's through networks, through people, through the work that you're actually doing, through making mistakes and learning from those, then that fuels me. And I also think that's also what I then bring back to my family too. And my home life is it's all connected. And the things I'm learning at work and the things I'm learning at home, yeah, they all tie together.
I love that answer. I think about the scale of the problem you're trying to solve right now, which I can't think of a model where anyone has set such an audacious goal for something that is so systemically, deeply challenging. And now I think the current climate makes it exponentially more difficult. So when you are faced with the biggest, hairiest problems, like the one you are currently facing, where do you begin, Kirsten?
Yeah. So the fundamental objective of our organization is twofold. And so one is that 100,000 hiring target at our member companies. But the other, and really this is the overarching one, is systemic change. So the first one is meant to be a driver and an indicator that we are moving in the right direction. Systemic change is really, really hard and takes a long, long time. What I think is so special about this organization and the CEOs that founded it and funded is that they set that 100,000 hiring target. Those are hiring low-income New Yorkers into jobs at their companies. This is not they're funding an organization that's hiring for someone else. And so that was meant to hold them accountable, but it was also meant to hold me and my team accountable, because if the things we're doing are working for JP Morgan, Citibank, or working for Google and IBM, then they should be good enough to work for small and mid-sized financial service companies, small and mid-sized tech firms. So it was never about them just hiring people into their own companies. That is sort of a means to an end to then help develop these proof points that can be scaled, but ultimately help the city more broadly. And so I think in general, when tackling a really daunting task or objective, breaking it down into digestible pieces is, in my experience, the only way to move forward. And so this is just a really big example of that. And this is where the power of the collective comes in. All of them doing that together is even better. But anyone can apply that, I think, to challenges in their personal or professional life. One thing I learned from a leadership course that Bloomberg had sent me to once was that I've continued to do was a suggestion of, at the beginning of every year, writing yourself a letter as though it was the end of that year, 12 months later, and you're writing about what happened that year as though it went exactly how you wanted it. And I remember when they asked us to do this, I thought, ugh, this is like touchy-feely and a waste of time, and I have so much work to do. Why am I sitting in this class? And then I remember I was pregnant at the time, and so my letter went something like, I took care of myself during pregnancy. I prepared my team, so I had a really smooth transition to parental leave. And then on parental leave, I did XYZ so that I had a really smooth transition back. And I'm just using those because they're easy examples. But it was, okay, well, so what has to happen in order for that to happen? And so it's, well, then let's back into it. It means I need to start preparing my team XYZ here. It means I need to start going to, I don't know, prenatal yoga once a week. And it sort of forces you to map out, one, your priorities at the highest level, which I think is just so important. Like, it's rare someone actually just says to you, what are your priorities? Not your boss's priorities, but like, what are your priorities? And holistically across both your personal and professional life, and not taking one in a vacuum. And then two, how do you get there? And then you map it out. And then three, so now you can hold yourself accountable along the year to those steps. Am I behind? Have I done that? And I just think that's great. And there's so many times for me that I find the things that are causing stress are actually not the big things. It's more the lack of structure. For example, oh my gosh, my husband and I are not seeing each other. We're shifts in the night. We're traveling. Well, then put date night on the calendar like every week. And granted, it'll get moved 1 out of 2 weeks, but at least it's there. It's so much harder to do this when you're then feeling like we haven't seen each other. Let's do that. And the same with work. You want to launch a big marketing campaign. That was one of mine for 2024. Well, then I got to hire a marketing director. Let's step one. And so rather than sometimes we find ourselves just sitting around thinking about things we want to do and sort of feeling like paralyzed in what the first step is because it's such a big thing. When you break it down, I find that is much easier to feel achievable and also to hold yourself accountable to the things you need to do and the timeline you need to do it on.
I love it. And I was really curious how you prioritize, and that answer, I think, provides so much universally relevant insight for us. And it is this practice of zooming out, getting a big picture, and then zooming in way down to the details. And from a behavior change standpoint, what we're often talking about is, yes, getting really clear on what your intentions and aims are, and then what makes it hard.
Yeah. And for you,
what makes it easy?
I think what's interesting is, in some cases, the older I've gotten, the more, and probably just because I've taken on the role of wife, mother, but community member, but I feel like the more it's easy to get confused on, is this what I want or is this what I'm supposed to want? And so to your point about prioritization, never in the last 8 years that I've done this letter, like, has cooking dinner every night come up. Now that's a thing that I often feel like would used to feel bad about. Like, I'm not home cooking dinner every night. I'm not home cooking dinner every night. But am I feeling bad about that because that's important to me? Or am I feeling bad about it because a lot of other moms are home in time to cook dinner at night? And so I could have picked that over date night and like said, going to be home to cook dinner every night. And that would also be an achievable goal. And we would map it out and we'd put it on the calendar. But I didn't. And so it forces you to be really honest with yourself about what you want, what makes you happy. And again, you can't do that when you're have both, you know, a work and a personal life without taking the two together.
Yeah. I call that the art of strategic neglect.
Yes.
Here is what I will strategically not be feeling guilty for.
Yeah. So now occasionally my kids are like, oh my God, mom's cooking. And look at that. And it's fine. They're going to grow up knowing mom does not cook very often. That's okay. They see a lot of other good things.
Absolutely. And maybe they're learning to cook a little sooner. Learning ways to manage meal making outside of cooking, right? It teaches resourcefulness. We're never going to get all the things done.
No.
So we might as well be honest and then move on, because I do think one of the most distracting things that gets in our way is all of the shoulds and the ought tos, when oftentimes they're not even aligned with what we really care about.
Right. And I think sometimes we also diagnose stress. It's human nature to just blame it on work. Like, oh, I feel stressed out. It's because of work. And I think that kind of isn't really doing justice to work, because sometimes it's because of work, but sometimes it's because your kids have a hectic schedule, or you haven't gotten to the gym, or like other, I mean, but that it's not always work. And so I think being really clear on what it is that's causing you stress, and then how can you mitigate that so that all aspects of your life are more fluid, is important.
And then it's realistic about what fits your life instead of just this like imaginary life.
Exactly.
You talk about eating the frog first as a part of how you structure your life, your days. Share a little bit more about this, because I feel like the more I talk to trailblazers, people who are the first of their kind in the room that they're in, this has come up over and over again. And so I think there's a lesson for all of us who are doing hard things.
Yeah. I will say, I used to be like in college, younger, such a procrastinator. I would be the person pulling all-nighters. I'm the person doing paper the night before. And I think that's contributed to multiple things, but just never really learned time management or executive functioning skills probably that I needed to. And then when I got to the workplace, I realized that's not going to work. That's not going to work. And so I started looking into some of like best practices. How can I make myself more efficient? And there's this eat the frog saying, which comes from Mark Twain, saying if you eat a frog at the beginning of every day, it'll be the worst thing that happened to you that day, or nothing worse will happen. But it essentially means like do the thing that you dread doing, or that is challenging, or that isn't fun. Just get it, but it has to get done. Just get it out of the way in the morning. And for me, that works for two reasons. One, I'm most productive in the morning. So if I don't do it then, it's probably definitely not going to get done, or it's not going to get done well, particularly if it's something that requires any sort of strategic thinking. And two, otherwise it just looms over you all day. And so I think I find it's a great way to start the day. It also then feels like you've built some momentum that you just keep, you can go, oh wow, I checked that off my list. And that's one that I really feel good about checking. And by the way, that also can be personal or professional. It could be calling your mom back if that's something that you've been dreading to.
If that's the most complex thing of the day.
I think for some people that might be. Not me. Yeah. I have a lovely mom.
Yeah.
But it could be having a difficult conversation with an employee. It could be, writing a briefing that is just going to take a lot of time and energy. But it always feels really good to get it done. And I find it's a great way to start the day.
Yeah. Hard problems never solve themselves.
No. Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JP Morgan, who is the chair of our board, has a saying that problems don't age well. It says a lot. It says, the same concept. Like if you have to deliver bad news, do it right away. If you have to take accountability, do it now. Like nothing gets better. Those tasks don't go away. Things only become more complex. Yeah. Do it now.
I think about them as acute and chronic pain.
Yeah, that's a great way to think about it.
I would rather manage the acute pain, knowing that it might be a little more uncomfortable in the immediate term, than suffer with it for weeks, months, years, decades.
Absolutely. Yeah.
The cumulative effect is way lower.
The cumulative effect, yeah. And I think also the weird thing about procrastination is the longer you do it, the longer it's like it's a snowball. Becomes harder and harder to break that cycle, at least for me.
So if we think of this as a challenge of eating the frog first or managing the trickiest stuff first, what has been the hardest part of helping these organizations accomplish this giant KPI-led goal?
So the hardest part is there's no roadmap. Like this hasn't, to your point earlier, systemic change, at least at the workforce development education systems level in our city, but in this is not just our city, really hasn't happened in a very long time. So that's hard already, is that no one's handing you, here's your strategic plan, here's your manual, here's what you have to deliver on. So the constant sort of experimentation, execution, iteration, data collection, all of that just is, we're always in that learning and iterating mode. And I imagine we will be for a very long time. It's not like we just had to land on one product and get it right and we're done. So that's, I think, the hardest part about what this organization does. The easiest, and now I'll say, the easiest part about what this organization does is that we have the support of some of the most influential CEOs leading innovative organizations that are the, I cannot think of a better group to be driving, you know, skilling, to be driving, ensuring our future workforce in New York City is skilled and competitive. They're leading real time on developments in AI. They're leading real time in developments in healthcare. Who better to know? And what a great group of employers to signal to the community what's needed. I say that's the easiest thing, and that's a blessing. Like that is such a gift that I have in leading this organization. But I think also one of my biggest challenges is how do you leverage them? And that's a big part of my job. The thing with CEOs is that are committed to a cause, like they're there, they're all in, and anything they're leading from the top. They want to do it, they can do it. But you have to know the right ask. I think that in itself can be really challenging. We've all been in this position before. You're someone looking for job advice or so. You're like, how can I help? You need someone to tell you, right? And so figuring out what the right asks are and for the right organizations so that it will to be able to connect to the work that needs to get done is how I spend a lot of my time. But I feel like every day I am aware that this is mine to lose. If this group of business leaders cannot get it done, if our organization with the support of them cannot get it done under my leadership, then I'm the wrong leader. Then like that's a problem. We can't blame it on anything. Back to like blaming stress on work. You can't blame it on anything else because you've got all the support you need there to tackle this really hard challenge.
Okay. I need to know more about both of these. On that one first, like how do you hold that level of agency and accountability without feeling completely overwhelmed or like paralyzed just by the level of responsibility?
I mean, I think it's a little bit like what we talked about earlier. You just have to take a deep breath and break it down into steps and put one foot in front of the other. I mean, you have to do something. You need to move forward. So I think that. But I also am a really big believer in knowing your customer. This is one of when I spent 15 years at Bloomberg and really grew up professionally there. And one of their five core values is knowing your customer. And that means different things in different roles and in different organizations. But what it means to me here is I need to know both my companies and I need to know my end user, which is most cases students, either New York City Public High School students, CUNY students, or faculty advisors, anyone in that ecosystem. And I think that's in my experience, the best way to be able to figure out what the right ask is or the right foot to put in front of the other. Sometimes I found like the more senior you get in your career, sometimes the further away you get from the end user, if you will, and it becomes around like speculation and decks and questions and you don't have the right people in the room to answer. It's like a bunch of people that are too far apart to answer the questions. And so you're kind of just guessing at the problem and you're guessing at the answer. And sometimes the answer is just go ask the right person. And that might be a 20-year-old CUNY student. Go ask them, would this work for you? Would this be helpful? Go ask our companies. Is this something you could help with? Is this expertise that you have? Is this something you've thought of? And back to asking questions, like I think there aren't any dumb questions, but it's not helpful to ask questions, you know, to the wrong audience. So that we spend a lot of time talking to students, learning from them. And I spend a lot of time, you know, diverse team in all aspects of the world. We're talking to them. What are you hearing? What was your experience? And then talking to our companies at all levels as well. It's not, the CEO has a very different perspective than an entry-level recruiter who you know, can offer an incredibly valuable perspective on where in the pipeline students are falling through or where are they performing. And the person in the marketing team can offer different perspective on sort of how does the company view themselves in this effort and what's going to be important to them, you know, to get out of or to get out of it.
What I really take from that is that you're collecting data in order to make these decisions, and that that is taking the responsibility off of, I think where we get paralyzed in our thinking is, oh my gosh, it's all on me. I've got to get this right. And it becomes about me and not the problem. And you're out gathering the data to understand the problem. And so then it's about, well, where can I add value to solving this problem? And largely it is consolidating all of the insights. And it's interestingly, almost word for word, what Melissa Aviles Ramos said on this show. And so for those listening, she's the commissioner of the NYC DOE. So she's also talking to the same students that Kirsten is.
Yes. No, I know Melissa. Yes. No, that's, I love that. No, it is. You synthesize that much better than I did. It is data collection, analysis, whatnot. But earlier on in my career, I felt this pressure to try and fit the mold of what I thought a leader looked like. And I do think you think, mm-hmm. oh, it's someone who has all the answers mm-hmm. and is all knowing and just makes decisions and moves quickly. And then you realize that's not at all what it is. And if it was at one time, I don't know, it was before my time, but I can tell you it's not ever going to be again because of the pace of change that just is happening right now and will only speed up and not slow down. It is impossible for a leader to know everything. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's all about mm-hmm. surrounding yourself with people that fill in the gaps of being self-aware, surrounding yourself with people that fill in the gaps of where you know your strengths and weaknesses are, and then leveraging that data collection process, both from your team and you know, from your customer, if you will, but not getting stuck in the process. There is such a thing as like analysis paralysis too. And at some point you have to make a call. And that's really the job of a leader. It's like to know when the time is to make that call. Okay, we've got enough to make an informed decision. And then, you know, pick a path.
Yeah, it's asking the right questions. And so I want to go back to that because there is so much universal relevance for all of us who are doing big, brave things that we do have to ask for help. Nobody's ever done a big, brave thing alone. And yet it's not just like willy-nilly, what do you think?
No.
Or how can I help, right? Like,
no, you need the right, it has to be the targeted yes questions, yes.
So tell us how you think about that when you're asking guys whose time is worth like more thousands of dollars an hour than I can even like fathom.
I don't even want to do the math. Yeah, totally.
Right, like.
Exactly. Yeah.
To quantify an hour of Jamie Dimon's time.
Yeah. Yeah, let's not do
way
that.
Outside of mine.
I'm sure someone's done that somewhere.
I'm sure.
Well, I think, again, it depends on your audience, the questions you're asking. So I think that's where the wrong question to ask for CEOs is just, how can you help? That's the wrong question,
yeah.
Right?
So
you have to ask some other people some questions to even figure out how you think they can help. And then I think this is where we see you could add a lot of value. Here's an example. CUNY came to us a couple summers ago and said, is there something we can do for tech students that didn't get an internship that will still help boost their resume come fall when they're applying for jobs? And so back to knowing your customer, I thought Google, they put $100 million into Google career certificates. A lot of those are in tech. Let's go talk to Google. And so you go to Google, say, hey, is this something you all could help us with? Yes. I have a student engagement team. The right question for them is, how would we engage students? How many students do you think? Because Google says, how many licenses do you think you need? Okay, how many students do we think we can get? Anyway, bottom line, you end a place. We signed 5,000 students up for Google career certificates over, I don't know, a couple of weeks. We then went to our employers and said, hey, if they finish them in 2 months, could we give them an incentive that they'll at least get a first round screening for the jobs that map to the various certifications? Our employers say yes. That was the right question of the HR professionals, the employers, wrong question for the CEOs. And so I think that's a good example of where you can leverage a collaborative in multiple different ways, work across our different stakeholders to know what expertise to leverage and what the right questions are. And then you end up with a solution that had some really great outcomes.
I love that example. And I think what I'm taking from it is asking the right questions in any area is doing your homework to understand the expertise and resources of the person you're asking, and understanding what need you're meeting for them as well.
100%. I mean, look, I grew up at a commercial private sector company. So coming into the nonprofit world, it was surprising to me how many individuals and nonprofits had the mentality of business has to do this. This doesn't have to do anything. They have to make a profit. They have to pay their employees. They have shareholders they have to report to. Other than that, that's pretty much all they have to do. And so I think that, of course, there has to be a value proposition. There has to be a reason. And now that reason can just be it's the right thing to do. And you have business leaders that are really committed to doing it. But when I look at our mission, if you're trying to change a whole city, it has to be bigger than just relying on business leaders who are committed to doing the right thing. It has to work. And so it has to work for everyone. Job seekers have to get something out of it. Companies have to get something out of it. In this case, talent. So that's a great one. But also, when I took this job, we came in at a time when many of our CEOs were calling for people to be back in the office, so full or part-time, but moving more and more. Okay, so what has to happen for employees to come back into the office? Well, they need to feel safe taking the subway. They need to have a place to buy lunch and coffee when they get off the subway to get to the office. So all of those things, now is our mission to stand up bodegas or police subways? No, but it's all connected. And so I think that's where, and our mission isn't to drive people to go to work in office every day, but all of this still comes back to economic mobility and jobs. And so investing in solutions like the ones that we do, it's so much bigger than just the people in the jobs, the butts in the seats. It's the whole ecosystem. And so again, you have to think about how does this solution benefit that full ecosystem, or you're going to run into an issue of either unsustainability or unscalability, if that's a word.
You're constantly asking questions. You're a learner. You have amassed a wealth of what I call courage capital by doing hard things and proving to yourself that you are capable of solving big, hairy problems and doing that in collaboration with your teams. Does anything scare you as a leader still?
I think most people, or certainly me, we're all scared of failure. It doesn't mean it's not going to happen, and it happens small or big ways.
Being scared of it doesn't stop it from happening.
Look at that. Also a waste of time, being scared of the failure. But yeah, look, I think back to my point around, are we leveraging the counsel that we have to the extent that we can, is probably always that's the same, that me asking that question every day is probably what scares me the most is, are we having as big of an impact as we could? Are we leaving impact on the table? So it's less around like, yes, we're driving numbers and we're hiring people, and I don't anticipate that we'll stop, but we're doing great work. But could we be doing more? I think that's kind of always a question. And I think in any job, it's not just a nonprofit job, you're always kind of wondering, could you be doing more? I always wonder, could I be doing more as a mother? It's like, I mean, it's just a, and so for me, it's less about what am I not doing and more about, am I leaving anything on the table? Am I not maximizing the resources and that I have? Yeah, have that desired impact.
And it sounds like that intention setting, visioning exercise that you do each year really helps clarify what that is. How do you take care of yourself in this rather high pressure, high stakes role?
I think, look, I live by the calendar. I don't want this to be a huge theme of this podcast, but I find the calendar is just the root of so much of what makes my life work. Mm-hmm. And so I think being thoughtful about finding time, whether it's to exercise, time with my husband, time with my kids, for me, scheduling in the work-life balance, if you will, it's a terrible term, and it sounds weird to say schedule it, but be my scheduling in. I think that's what manages me. And I think when I find myself feeling untethered is when either I haven't done as good a job of that, or again, obviously there are times in life where work will ramp up, you don't get to the gym, you don't see your kids as much, but making sure that you sort of make up that time on the flip side, then that there are going to be times work gets more of you or of me. There's many times that my family gets more of me. There's times that me gets more of me, taking care of yourself and just recognizing that, not beating yourself up over it and keeping an eye on that balance.
Yeah, well said. And I think not looking at it as an either or, but thinking about it as each domain getting its due when it needs it most.
Yeah. And I think that, trying to compartmentalize work and personal life, I find impossible. Like, it's all so connected. And the older I get and the more I grow professionally, it just only amplifies that. And so, again, for me, it's all figuring out stuff for you. But for me, I found that, you know, doing a little bit of work on my maternity leaves, no one asked me to, in case Bloomberg's listening, they absolutely did not ask me to do work. But for me, staying kind of connected, I carved out a couple hours a week or whatever, was a small amount of time to take away from my newborn child in the scheme of things. But it was huge for me coming back to work. And again, I just knew that about myself. I felt like if I came back and felt disoriented or then reorgs and I didn't know, you know, just staying in the loop. And that enabled me to then spend more time with my child when I got back to work. It's similar, the same principle on vacation. Like, if all of us have had that experience, you go on vacation and then you come back and then the first few days are awful because you're just catching up. And so I do my best to also try and stay again, small amount of time to invest on vacation so that when I come back, I can feel like I don't lose all the relaxation I just gained by feeling overwhelmed. Again, that looks different on different people, but I think being self-aware and then thinking through how you can mitigate those things happening is very helpful.
Yeah, I think it also goes back to what you're saying about taking a more integrated approach. I call it wearing the kimono. And it really is. It's just like wrapping all of our lived experience, our expertise, our interest, and our many hats that we wear, especially as women, and allowing ourselves to sort of create a new, unique version of what leadership looks like, as opposed to this archetypal version that we had in our minds, or that we tried to narrow ourselves and squeeze into maybe when we were younger.
And it's also, it's never been easier. We have all the tools to do it now. Most all employees or people working do. And I think post-COVID, one of the positive things is that now our lives all did get more integrated, whether we liked it or not. And you were working at home and you were, you know, working at off times and whatever. But I think that also helps you figure out, right, on a certain day, balance could mean like jumping back on work at night. And this is for so many people, because I wanted to be in my daughter's music class that day. I think that that's actually a benefit of today, is that those things are all possible. Whereas a generation before, that wasn't an option, which I imagine was much harder.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Every woman on the show nominates a woman she admires who's doing big, brave things in the world to be a guest on the show. So who is the woman who inspires you?
Well, so if you have not had her yet, you should have my friend Dusty Jenkins. She is the chief public affairs officer for Spotify. Huge job. And Dusty's amazing. Our children were in preschool together, so we met several years ago. And one of the things I love about Dusty is she has always had enormous responsibilities and roles at very young ages. She was chief communications officer for Target before that. She's worked in some presidential administrations and is also incredibly approachable, incredibly present. She's all the things. Dusty is someone that I really admire. She's someone I go to for work advice. And she's incredibly authentic. When I think of examples, when you ask me that question, all of the women's faces that popped into my mind are women that are very authentic, again, across all aspects of their life. What you see is what you get, and you get the same version. And again, going back to earlier in my career, you feel like you have to fit a mold of what a leader looks like, feel like you need to dress a certain way or sound a certain way. And I think once I learned to let go of that and feel confident that the things that make me distinct are also the things that distinguish me professionally, that's when I feel like things started ramping up. Honestly, it started. But it's hard to get to that place. It's hard to sort of give yourself that permission. There's a woman named Helena Morrissey. She lives in London. She was, when I met her, CEO of Newton Asset Management, which is arm of the Bank of New York Mellon. I think they had like a fund of $85 billion. She was in her 40s. The CEO, she has 9 children.
Oh my.
9. No twins. It's 9 pregnancies. I found it so hard to even have 2 pregnancies and work. I remember thinking, before the first time I was going to meet Helena, she was a Bloomberg client. And also she had started the first 30% club, the whole initiative. And then gradually chapters in other cities started up. And I ended up helping found the US chapter. But so before the first time I met her, I remember thinking, well, there's no way I'm going to like her. Like, what woman is a CEO at 45 on all these most powerful women lists and has 9 children. Like, that's just impossible. She must be like, because you don't get everything. Well, no, I only got everything.
And gotta be something wrong.
And she comes like, you know, briskly walks into the room, and she's also tall and thin and beautiful and always impeccably dressed. And she's feminine and she's her. And I remember thinking, like, she's wearing a big skirt and like a brooch and maybe some ruffles. And she's living in this very male dominated industry of financial services. And like, this is not what I was expecting. I was expecting a black suit. And so I think that Helena really is, when I think about when I first started to kind of reconsider if my preconceived notions of what a leader is supposed to look like were actually accurate. And I realized, like, this is also why she's memorable. She is who she is. You can be a CEO and also care about fashion. You can, you know, talk about your 9 children all the time without that feeling like you can't be a CEO. And I think we've made huge strides in the sense that women today are much more apt to talk about the fact that they are not superhuman. They have challenges. Whereas even when I was in my 20s, it was more often than not that you'd see a panel of women talking about things. They were not talking about their children. They were not talking about challenges. It was very, and I think also women didn't have necessarily as much freedom to do so, just given where we were. But so I remember in my mind thinking, these women look like they're superhuman. They must not sleep. They don't make mistakes. They are perfect. And I am not. I know I am flawed. And so how will I ever get to be in that position? And that's always going to be an entirely unachievable goal. If people see leaders and think you can't have flaws if you want to get to that position. And that's a terrible message to be sending to young people. And I think now people are much more comfortable, I'm happy saying, like, no, there are times that are really hard. There are times that are challenging. I cry sometimes. I mean, like, I'm a human being. And I thought, you know, pregnancy was really hard. It was a challenge every day. And so I think that is really a positive sign and healthy as a society that we're seeing that more, because you want young people to know that it's okay to be flawed and people aren't superhuman. And I think the earlier you can have that realization and then get to the stuff we were talking about earlier, like, okay, identify those flaws and then figure out how to mitigate them or like build supports around you, then the better, right? I mean, and also otherwise we're going to lose out on good talent that's going to take themselves out of the game before they even get where we go.
Yeah. It's the silence that blocks the systemic change. In the same way that if you want people to go back to the office, there needs to be a place to get coffee.
Yes.
Right, it's contextual enablers for what's happening in reality in the experience, not just the outcome.
Yeah, and I think that for so long it was like the secret. Maybe I'm trying to think of the right way to word this. I knew someone at Bloomberg who had children, and she and another colleague both had children. They had this sort of like secret code between them where they put in their calendar some code word, but it basically meant I've got a kids thing, I got a school parent teacher conference, I've got a something. And at Bloomberg,
and they felt like they had to do that, I'm sure.
And they felt like they had to do that. And I remember someone telling me that and saying, did you know so-and-so and so, they do this? What a great idea. Like, that's such a great idea. And I said, I don't know. And I love the idea because, to be honest, like, I'm glad it's a way to work, but it kind of feels like a Band-Aid. And also, it doesn't do anything to help set the role modeling or the example for other people. And so I was very mindful and intentional, I guess, around when I did come back to work after my first child. And granted, I was in a senior enough position that I felt confident taking the time that I needed. I didn't ask anyone to go anywhere. But so I thought, given that I'm in this position, that's a gift. I also want to make sure I'm then role modeling in. So I'd say, I just got back from Asia for 2 weeks. Guess what? I'm going to Elin's music class, tomorrow morning. I'll be in late. I've got a work dinner tonight. So I'm going to go home early and see the kids and then go out there. And I think that just sort of shows the evolution of, like, women couldn't make it work. Women figured out ways to make it work. And now this can be the norm, and you can also be really proud of making it work.
Yeah. Yeah. And it really took women at the top being willing to take that risk, because the women at the bottom of an organization, the lowest paid, the hourly workers,
no,
they're not going to be the first ones who can say that.
No, or they have to ask permission, or they
exactly.
Yeah, exactly. And so
there's no precedent. No.
And they shouldn't have to be. You shouldn't have to be blazing from the bottom in those scenarios when there are people that can do it without putting their jobs at risk.
mm-hmm. who have that authority. It is so wonderful to talk to you. And I'm so excited by the work that you're doing, Kirsten, and the way that you're doing it. So as uplifters, we love to uplift other uplifters. So how can we, as non-CEOs of the biggest organizations in the world, support the work that you're doing?
Wherever you're listening from, it is so important to be supporting your local talent. Ultimately, everything we're doing is about connecting local talent to jobs. And I cannot drive home enough. That is good for everyone. Everybody benefits. Your economy benefits, your businesses benefit, your job seekers benefits, your safety benefits, community benefits. And so I think the more people can be intentional about hiring from their backyard, the better. And that's a good thing, because if you're intentional about it, you'll either hire people or you realize that there's a gap. And if there's a gap, then think about how you can fill that gap with skills. And I think that the more, the beauty of this effort is that we work with the public sector, but we are funded and led by the private sector. And the private sector, traditionally, it hasn't been its job to skill people. You get them once they're skilled. That's education's job in our country. And so that's not going to work long term. And so thinking through how can businesses, and you could be a small business, a big business, lean in to close those gaps on skilling, career readiness, awareness, career exploration, all those things is really important, because a lot of change right now in our country requires private sector leadership and sort of proof points to then get public sector leadership and funding. And that's ultimately what makes it sustainable. So it's this whole life cycle of things. I'm really happy to see the private sector recognize it has this opportunity and responsibility to step up to a job that technically is not its job. Like, that's not in our scope. Yeah. But recognizes why this is good for everyone. And so that would be my call to action for people, just to be thinking about local talent, hiring local talent, and skilling local talent.
It sounds like a good moment too to call out one of our former guests, Holly Diamond. She's brilliant. She's got a Robinhood funded startup in New York City. It's map-based hiring software. And so it's basically Google Maps for hourly workers.
That's so cool.
And isn't it brilliant? So it's like the mom and pop sign that says hiring. Where do those go? They just go in a window that's a sign that maybe somebody will pass by. And so this is a map-based software that says, look on this map and you'll see all the jobs in your area that are hiring specifically newer Americans and lower income folks who are looking for
What a great, I'm definitely going to look that up. That is brilliant.
Smart.
And I will also say, if you have listeners, if you're one of those hourly workers that is applying for jobs elsewhere, or like other jobs or higher skill jobs, one of the things we find is people often leave those jobs off their resume, or they don't know how to articulate the transferability of those skills. And so we work predominantly with the public college students at the 25 CUNY schools in New York City. And every CUNY student I've ever met works at least part-time. Many are working full-time while also going to school. So that in itself, they have time management, responsibility. Those are transferable skills. And then you talk to the person that's working at Starbucks or Spanktel, or like, you have customer service experience. You've been yelled at by customers. You've had a boss. You may have been a boss. Yeah. And all of those are things that employers value, that stuff, more today than I've ever seen in the past. And so it's only going to keep happening, because the more and more that, you know, generative AI is totally transforming the workplace and what jobs look like and the skills that employers value. And those are the things that it's not replacing. And those are the things that I think are hard to vet with a student that's just straight out of college, unless that student can demonstrate them other ways, because it's not going to show up on your transcript.
No.
But saying, I've had this job, or I had caregiving responsibilities, I was a lifeguard, like all of those are really important. And so just since you mentioned that hourly workers have to put in that plug as well, those skills are making those students more and more competitive than their peers. And I will say, this past year, our member companies had roughly 1,000 CUNY interns. And the end of the summer, the CUNY interns were 22% more likely to get full-time offers than their peers. So to me, this is just my own interpretation. It's because of those other skills. They've got other skills on top of the same skills everybody else has.
Experience is power.
It is.
Right. And I think especially now, as you said, in a time when AI is really transforming how we work and what we as humans are most needed for.
Yeah. And so lean into.
And that is my biggest worry. I'm like, I have a lot of lived experience. And so I think one of the big questions we're all asking is like, what will lived experience look like for the next generation who don't have the same or even the similar career journey as the past generation?
Yeah. And so it's back to lean into the things that differentiate you. And that could be your job at Starbucks.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love that you bring up caregiving because I think that's such an important and relevant one. So great to talk to you. I can't wait to see what you guys do. We'll be following along with so much excitement for you in this project. For those of you listening, I'll put links to Kirsten's work in the show notes. Please follow along with her and support this work and this mission.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Uplifters podcast. If you're getting a boost from these episodes, please share them with the Uplifters in your life and then join us in conversation over at theuplifterspodcast.com. Head over to Spotify, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast and like, follow, and rate our show. It'll really help us connect with more Uplifters and it'll ensure you never miss one of these beautiful stories. Mwah! Big love.
Painted water sunshine with rosemary and thyme. Dwelling up perplexing, though you find it vexing. Toss a star and hover, be your own best lover. Relish in a new prime, plant a tree in springtime. Dance with idle hindsight, bring the sun to twilight. Lift you up, whoa. Lift you up, whoa. Lift you up. Lift you up, lift you up, whoa. Lift you up, whoa. Lift you up, whoa. Lift you up.
In the pre-chorus, right?
I was like...
Mommy, stop crying. Mommy, stop crying. You're disturbing the peace.